This is Science Friday. I'm Rachel Faltman, host of Popular Science's The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week and Scientific American's Science Quickly. I'm back here at Sci-Fi today to fill in for Ira Flatow while he's on vacation. Later in the hour, we'll dive into the mysterious world of eels and explore their surprising connection to crime. But first, this week, a New Hampshire man died of Eastern equine encephalitis, a rare but serious mosquito-borne virus. Human cases have also been reported in Wisconsin, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Vermont, prompting some municipalities to step up their mosquito control efforts and even advise residents to limit outdoor activities during dusk and dawn. Joining me now to talk about this and other recent science stories is Sophie Bushwick, senior news editor at New Scientist in New York. Welcome back, Sophie.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So tell me more about this virus. What is it and how concerned should we be?
So the good news is Eastern equine encephalitis is still very rare. It has killed 5 people in the U.S. this year, but that is 5 people out of the whole U.S. population.
Right.
So it is definitely a concern. The problem with this disease is it has a 30% mortality rate, and it can cause permanent damage to people who fall ill with it. You know, they can have problems for the rest of their lives. So it's absolutely a threat that we should be taking seriously, but I don't think that folks need to be, you know, living in fear necessarily.
Right. That makes sense. And this isn't the only mosquito-borne disease out there, of course. In fact, last week we saw a disease specialist, Dr. Fauci, recovering from West Nile virus.
That's right. A lot of these mosquito-borne diseases are actually spiking a bit alarmingly. We've also seen much higher cases of a disease called Oropouche virus in South America. Brazil alone has had an 800% increase in the number of cases. And the mosquito-borne disease dengue as well. We've got almost double the cases this year compared to last year. And last year was at a record high. Dengue can cause symptoms similar to flu, but it can also, in severe cases, cause bad bleeding that can cause shock and then death.
Wow. And what do we know about why all of these are spreading?
Well, for this one, we can pretty much blame climate change. Mosquitoes love warm weather. They love wet weather. So basically, if you are sweating and uncomfortable, a mosquito is going to be very happy. And climate change is not just making their season longer, it's also making their geographic range broader. So they're able to spread into areas where maybe they wouldn't have been able to survive previously.
I'm unhappy. The mosquitoes are happy. Nobody's
I know.
Winning.
Yeah, mosquitoes love biting me and I hate being bitten, but it's unfortunately the way it is.
So is there anything that people can do to protect themselves?
Yes, the same measures that you take to avoid getting bitten by mosquitoes will help protect you from mosquito-borne disease. So things like staying indoors during the time of day when mosquitoes are most active, which tends to be around dusk, that can help. Wearing bug spray, wearing maybe long sleeves and pants if you know you're going to be out for a long time. Putting screens on your windows and doors is helpful, and just making sure there's no standing water around. So if you have an outdoor container that tends to get filled up with rainwater, make sure you're emptying that out. The other option is pesticide spraying. So we tend to be very cautious about this because DDT caused a lot of problems historically. But one option that Massachusetts is using right now is a different pesticide. It's called Anvil 10 plus 10. And they send people a warning to stay indoors during the time when they're spraying, which is very helpful for avoiding having problems with humans. Then they can spray the pesticide. It keeps down the mosquitoes and it protects folks from mosquito-borne illness.
Staying loosely on the climate topic, you have a story about something people can do to help the planet while they're behind the wheel?
That's right. This is a relatively minor intervention, but it can actually make a big dent in emissions from passenger vehicles. So if you've ever been in a car with someone who goes up to an intersection, you know that different drivers have different styles. Some people like to slowly glide up to the intersection, and some people kind of accelerate all the way there and then slam on the brakes. And it turns out that the gliding technique is better. If all cars glided up to intersections, then passenger vehicles could cut their total carbon emissions by like 5 to 10%.
It's funny, my brother-in-law has a hybrid and is one of those people who really pays attention to his efficiency, and he's been gliding all this time. He already knew it. How much of a difference can this make? Is it just like a thing people can do personally, or is there a way that cities or road planners could actually take advantage of this?
So one thing that's kind of cool about this is a lot of cars these days have some sort of semi-autonomous features. You know, you might have your car might help you stay within your lane, or some people, their cars can kind of take over when they're driving on the highway. But it could be programmed into smart cars like this to slow down automatically when they're approaching an intersection. It could set the pace for them. Another thing that could happen is the traffic signal. You could put a device in the traffic signal so it's communicating with the cars coming up and being like, you've got 5 seconds, or, you know, you're at a distance where you'd have to really accelerate to make it through. So instead, why don't you slow down and glide? And that way you'll have a less emissions heavy experience with this intersection.
Very cool. Okay, taking a hard turn now into the world of strange physics and dark matter. I know you have a story for us about those spooky physics things.
Yes, I have a very wimpy story for you. Wimpy as in weakly interacting massive particles, or WIMPs. So researchers know from looking at gravitational effects that about 80% of all matter is actually dark matter. But this is a mysterious substance that doesn't seem to even interact with light, which makes it really hard for us to detect it. And so we have a bunch of different theories about what it might be. And one of the leading ones is that it's a WIMP. It's this all these particles that interact very weakly with regular matter. And that's why we're not able to detect it. Despite that, researchers are trying to detect it. They've buried this detector about a mile underground called Lux Zeppelin. It's been running for about 280 days now, and it has found nothing.
Huh.
Yes. So,
is it that the particles aren't doing what they expected, or they're just not looking at the right particles? What do they think is going on?
So what they think is happening is just that the good news is they're able to restrict the limits of what these particles are able to do. It's sort of like one of the researchers compared this to searching through the ocean for a magical fish. So they've been searching, and they've searched about 75% of the ocean. So they know that either this magical fish is in the final 25% and they've got a better idea of where to look for it, or the other possibility is that the fish doesn't exist.
Wow.
The wimp fish.
That's wimpy physics for you. So, another mysterious thing, the brain during mating in fruit flies, naturally. Tell me more.
Yeah, so researchers have known that when male fruit flies are going through courtship and they're getting close to mating, they seem to be unable to visually detect threats nearby. And this isn't great for fruit fly longevity. You know, they need to be able to fly away from those predators. So they looked at their brains while the flies were going through courtship. And what they found was that towards the beginning of courtship, the male flies they simulated a predator using light and shadow nearby, and the male fly would say, oh no, okay, I'm getting out of here. But then as the fly got closer to sealing the deal, as it got closer to the mating moment, it seemed to lose the ability to detect that threat. And they found that dopamine in the brain was increasing as the fly got closer to achieving its goal. And they think that the dopamine is just blocking some of its sensory pathways, basically forcing it to tune out all distractions as it focuses on what it wants.
Wow. I mean, I guess that is kind of an evolutionary trade-off.
Yes, totally.
So moving up a bit in size, researchers are now looking at how marmoset monkeys address each other.
Yes, marmoset monkeys seem to use names to call each other. And this is the first non-human primates that we've seen this behavior in. So it's very exciting and also very cute. I would encourage folks to look up pictures of these marmosets. They're adorable.
Always good advice. And I know, yes, we actually have a sound of this. We're going to play some of these calls. But just a note, if you're listening in the car as opposed to with headphones, you probably won't hear it. It's very high pitched. We promise there is actually sound playing. You should go back and check it out later. Oh, yeah. Wow. So what are they saying? I love that. It's almost bird-like. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, these calls are called fee calls, which I think is an appropriate name for it. And basically, the researchers took a lot of recordings like this. They took recordings of marmosets in the lab, and marmosets tend to live in these close-knit monogamous family groups. So they took marmosets from three different families, and then they paired them up in different ways and listened to their calls. And then they used AI to analyze those calls and to pick out these very subtle acoustic differences in the way the marmosets called each other. And then they played recordings of these calls for marmosets to see how they responded. And And what they found was that marmosets make tweaks to their calls depending on which monkey they're addressing. So they're basically encoding specific information, which we would think of as like a label or a name in it. And different monkeys from the same family group will call a monkey with the same modulation. So like using the same name to refer to the same individual.
Oh, wow. So different marmosets have the same name for a specific marmoset.
Exactly. Yes.
That's very cool. So what does this teach us? You know, why do we care beyond the obvious? I care deeply. Why do scientists care?
Right. Well, we think that, you know, human language didn't just appear out of nowhere. We gained this ability. We probably developed it over time. And so by looking at animals like these marmosets or other species that seem to use name calls, so we've also seen this behavior in parrots, in Egyptian fruit bats, in elephants. So by looking at the way that this name use works in animals that don't use what we would think of as human language, we can learn more about how we develop the ability to speak.
Hmm. And finally, another kind of communication, music, and how human brains react to it. Tell me more about this.
That's right. So one of the things that makes it really fun to listen to a song is that it has distinct segments. And There's something between the segment called a musical boundary. It's sort of like when you know the beat's about to drop in a song, right? You're approaching the musical boundary. So fun. So researchers were like, well, what's going on in the brain when this musical boundary is coming up? And to find out, they took brain scans of these subjects while they were listening to three different, very different songs. So one of them was in the genre of Nuevo Tango from Argentina. Mm-hmm. One of them was progressive metal from the US. And then one of them was Stravinsky, so Russian ballet.
Waiting for the beat to drop in Stravinsky is underrated. And I'm not being sarcastic. That was one of the original beat drops, in my opinion.
It's a classic. And what they found was that when they were approaching that point, when they were approaching that musical boundary, a network in the subject's brains lit up. And then after they passed the boundary, a different network was lighting up. So it's sort of like your attention is shifting between these two areas. And they actually compared it to the way that our brains change attention to understand the differences between sentences in language.
Very cool. That's all the time we have for now. Sophie Bushwick is senior news editor at New Scientist. Sophie, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you.
After the break, they say crime doesn't pay, but eel crime? Turns out eel crime pays a lot. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Rachel Feltman. Eels have fascinated humans for thousands of years, captivating big thinkers like Aristotle and Freud. And they still make their way into pop culture even now. Here's a fun eel fact for you. Electric eels, not actually eels, not even a little bit. And vampire squids aren't vampires or squids. And also, a Brazil nut is technically a seed, not a nut. And anyway, what was I saying? Right, eels. So despite having been on planet Earth for about 200 million years, eels are still rather mysterious creatures. For instance, scientists still aren't sure exactly how they spawn. But all of those unanswered questions haven't stopped humans from wanting to eat them. And a lucrative criminal underworld has risen up to poach baby eels from the wild for exactly that purpose. Joining me now to talk all about her journey into the wild world of eels is my guest, Ellen Ruppel Schell, author of Slippery Beast, A True Crime History with Eels. She splits her time between Bremen, Maine and Somerville, Massachusetts. Ellen, welcome to Science Friday.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thanks so much for coming on. So I'll start with the most obvious question to ask someone who wrote a book all about eels, which is, why eels?
Well, that's a simple question and a complicated question. So the short answer is, I didn't find eels. Eels found me. Would you like to know the story behind that?
I would love to know the story behind that.
Okay. Well, quite a few years ago, as you mentioned, I spent about half the year on the coast of Maine. And one year, my husband and I decided we needed some help with home repairs. So we hired a guy who in the book I call Sam. Sometimes he'd come in quite early, come to my kitchen with a 4-pack of cider and just want to talk. And he'd tell me stories about his family and especially about his grandson, who he said he wanted to teach to fish as soon as he got the money together to buy a boat. And I said, well, Sam, why don't you mix business and pleasure and buy yourself a commercial fishing license to go with that boat? And he said, well, I did do that and I would do that, but, you know, the eels. And I said, what? What are you talking about? The eels? You afraid they're going to bite you or what? And he said, no, I'm not talking about eels big enough to bite you. I'm talking about the little eels, you know, the ones the size of your pinky finger. You know, the ones we call the glass eels or the elvers, the baby eels. Ever since the price of those eels went through the roof, it's been dangerous down by the river. And I said, what do you mean the price went through the roof? And he said, well, you know, they're about $2,500 a pound. Well, as you can imagine, that got me curious about the eel. And, you know, Sam left. Years went by. I couldn't get the eel out of my mind. And I started looking into it. And I found not only were the price was the price through the roof, but the eel was a most remarkable animal. And the natural history of this animal kind of paralleled the history of science. And I got pulled into this story, as do so many people who encounter the eel, and it just wouldn't let go.
Yeah. Well, there are so many absolutely fascinating eel facts in your book, but let's start with some very basic stuff. Can you give us a quick overview of the eel life cycle and why it confused scientists for so long?
Yeah, the eel is such a mysterious animal. No one knew how it reproduced. So Aristotle, you know, about 2,000 years ago, he started things going with this idea that eels reproduced by spontaneous generation, okay? And he held this theory, as did people for, you know, almost 2,000 years, this idea that eels just reproduced out of the mud. They did not sexually reproduce, but they reproduced out of the mud. And the reason for that is because eels were everywhere and no one had ever seen an eel mating. No one had ever seen an eel egg. No one had ever seen a pregnant eel.
So yeah, how and where eels breed has, of course, long been a mystery to scientists. Remind me, what do we know and not know about where they spawn?
Okay, well, it is thought today that the Atlantic eel, that is the European eel and the American eel, both spawn in the Sargasso Sea south of Bermuda. Again, it is thought no one has ever spotted a mature, sexually mature eel in the ocean or a mature eel in the ocean. And no one has ever spotted an eel egg in the wild, okay? So we're not absolutely sure of this, but it is thought that they spawn in the Sargasso Sea. In the case of the American eel, which is the eels we were talking about in Maine, it is spawned in the Sargasso Sea, and then it grows into a larval stage. And that larva, which is maybe 3 to 5 inches long, travels all the way from the Sargasso Sea up through the eastern seaboard, in the case of the Maine eels, up to the Maine coast. And as it crosses toward the coast, it becomes what we call a glass eel. They look like little transparent toothpicks. And then as it comes, it tends to come into the freshwater area. As it starts to do that, it becomes an elver. It becomes pigmented. And some eels stay in the ocean and some continue up the rivers and settle down into lakes or other places, other waterways, where it just eats. It becomes a yellow eel and it just eats and eats and grows and grows. And it can stay there for as long as up to 40 years. And then after it reaches a certain point, somehow it knows to return to its spawning place in the Sargasso Sea. It becomes what we call a silver eel. That's the last stage in its development. And it retraces its steps all the way back to a spawning ground where it spawns once or maybe twice, we're not sure, and then dies. And that's the life cycle of the eel. So you can imagine how difficult it was for ancient scholars to have any idea of how the eel reproduced.
Wow. Yeah. And as you were just describing, you know, eels have to migrate thousands of miles. Do we know how they do that navigation?
Oh, wow. Well, that was such a controversial question. I mean, some folks thought, some scientists thought it was olfaction because eels have an incredible sense of smell. Some felt that they were following the, you know, gravitational forces from the moon. There were all different theories. Most recently, it's been thought that they have a magnetic sense, that they have particles around their nose area, the front of their face, that are magnetically sensitive, and that they're drawn by the magnetic fields toward their destination, right? This, again, is controversial. I went to Norway to discuss this with a scientist who was most closely associated with this theory. Her name is Carolyn DeRaff. She's an amazing scientist, and she has a laboratory there where she did the experiments that resulted in this conclusion. It seems to be probably the most likely theory. They have a certain magnetic sense, eels do, that draws them to their destinations in both directions, both from the Sargasso Sea and back to the Sargasso Sea.
Wow. So personally, I had the pleasure, dubious honor of helping to catch some wild eels for research back when I was an undergrad. But I think most folks these days have their first eel encounter when they see, you know, maybe unagi at a Japanese restaurant, or maybe at like the Feast of the Seven Fishes if you have a particularly ambitious Italian grandma. But like other types of seafood, they've been overfished. So what are the statuses of the three populations of eels, the American, European, and Japanese eel?
Well, exactly. So there are about 820 different species of eels. And the ones that we think about, the freshwater eels, there are maybe 18 different species. And the most commercially viable ones are the Japanese eel, the American eel, and the European eel. Now, all those eels have declined in number dramatically since the 1970s. It's thought that the Japanese eel has declined by as much as 95%, the European eel by as much as 95%, and the American eel by about 50%. So, as you can see, the Japanese and European eel are both critically endangered. The American eel is not classified as critically endangered, but many scientists believe that it's on the verge of becoming quite endangered. It's certainly under threat.
Yeah, even going into your book as something of an eel enthusiast, one thing that really blew my mind was your deep dive into the international wild eel trade. So how is it that baby eels or elvers from Maine end up on eel farms in China?
Yes, so there's an elver season. So elvers are baby eels. There are about 2,500 of these eels to a pound, to give you some idea of how small they are. These eels are caught in the estuaries, generally, or in the rivers of Maine, in the case of the Maine eel. The only legal place to catch elvers in the United States is the state of Maine. There's a very small fishery in South Carolina, but it's really not significant. So the only significant elver fishery in the United States is the state of Maine. So they're caught on the coast during elver season, which starts in March and usually ends in June. And then they are shipped, by and large, they are shipped to farms in Asia, generally China, to be grown up to market size. It takes 6 months to a year to grow them to market size, after which they are slaughtered and prepared and sent back to the United States for sale. So it has the supply chain for the American eel in the United States is circuitous and dramatic, really, as the life cycle chain of the American eel. And in that process, as you can imagine, there's lots of room for slippage. Poachers, all sorts of things. International cartels are involved in this, criminal cartels, organized crime. It is the most costly wildlife crime on the planet. It's hard to imagine this, that elvers, not tiger paws, not ivory from elephants, elvers are the world's costliest wildlife crime.
Wow. And can you say a little bit more about what it is about the eel industry and the supply chain that lends itself to criminal enterprises?
Really, what it comes down to is money. Our other big product in Maine, of course, is lobster. Elvers are about 400 times the value of lobster. It's very, very valuable and quite, you know, relatively easy to ship and smuggle. And so unlike, you know, an elephant. Elvers are very, very small. So that has really brought in all sorts of, you know, criminal elements into this industry. It's as everyone told me, you know, eels are a dirty business, always have been. But since the price went through the roof, it's gotten very dangerous as well as dirty.
Hmm. And speaking of eel crime, you interviewed a kind of notorious eel kingpin named Bill Sheldon for the book. Can you tell me more about Operation Broken Glass?
Bill Sheldon is such an interesting guy. He's literally an expert on the eel, on the American eel. He has a degree in wildlife management. He's also a grandfather. He's not a young man. And Bill was the biggest eel dealer in the state of Maine. And unfortunately, as Bill himself will admit, he got greedy and he got involved in a poaching ring that involved six states up and down the East Coast that encouraged the illegal fishing of eels, elvers, and let's make sure we understand this, it's the baby eels that we're interested in, illegal fishing in states, you know, where it was not legal to fish elvers. And the elvers were then laundered through the state of Maine with Bill's help. And this Operation Broken Glass was a four-year federal investigation that ended in April of 2014 with the arrest of about 110 criminals up and down the East Coast. 22 people were imprisoned, including Bill Sheldon, who I interviewed about a month and a half after he got out of the state penitentiary. So unfortunately, with prices that high, even people with expertise and long experience of honest fishing of elvers got pulled into the trap of, you know, illegal activities.
But I'm sure some folks are wondering, you know, why don't we just catch and eat adults instead? But as you share in the book, wild-caught adult eels actually taste pretty bad. Can you explain why?
Yes. Well, eels, as I mentioned, can live a very, very long time. The ideal weight for an eel, especially in something like sushi, which is what the preparation that Americans prefer, those eels are small, relatively small, and you have to catch them at just the right time to get them that size. That's virtually impossible. You really can't time that in the wild. The other factor is, as I said, they do live a long time and they're bioaccumulators. Eels are very, very fatty and they store all sorts of things in that fat. And many river bottoms where they are nocturnal animals, during the day they burrow in the mud and absorb all sorts of toxins and, you know, unhealthy materials from that riverbed. Not only are you exposed to those toxins, but it doesn't taste very good. So many Americans do not like the taste of wild eel. And I had the opportunity to taste it myself in Norway. I did taste wild eel. I'm a big fan of domesticated eel or cultivated eel. I was really shocked at the taste of wild eel. You know, I sort of describe it as almost like a wet sponge taste. It's really, really not something that many of us would really enjoy.
Ugh, yeah.
Now, I've spoken to people who really do like it. You know, there's various countries, you know, certainly have a tradition of eating wild eel, but it really depends very, very much on where you get it, how old it is, all these factors that you really can't control. So cultivated eel is what the vast majority of eel eaten around the world is. It's not wild eel.
Right. And given everything you learned about the bad actors in the eel trade and the threats that eels face, should people just avoid eating eel altogether?
You know, that is such an interesting question and a complicated one. And many scientists told me people should not avoid eating eel because if we lose it as a commercial product, we're going to lose interest in it altogether. They would prefer that people continue to eat eel in moderation, but kind of know where it comes from and be mindful of where it comes from, just like so many things we think about eating, right? If we can do that, if we can balance, you know, our concerns, our environmental concerns with our hunger for eel, we'll be better off than if we just simply stop eating it.
Ellen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rachel.
Ellen Ruppelschell is the author of Slippery Beast, a true crime history with eels. She splits her time between Bremen, Maine, and Somerville, Massachusetts. If you want to read an excerpt of the book, go to sciencefriday.com/eels. That's sciencefriday.com/eels. We have to take a quick break, but we'll be back with new findings on another big science mystery, the origins of the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs. You won't want to miss this, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Rachel Feltman. Around 66 million years ago, an asteroid slammed into the Earth, spewed dust and rock everywhere, plummeted the planet into cold darkness, and ended the age of dinosaurs. It might be the most famous natural disaster in our planet's history, but scientists still have plenty of questions about it. Like, what was the asteroid made of? And where did it come from? A new study in the journal Science offers up some long-awaited answers. Lead author Dr. Mario Fischer-Gudde is a geochemist at the University of Cologne in Germany. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, hi there. Many thanks for having me.
So let's get into it. Were you able to figure out what the asteroid was made of?
Yes, we definitely found an answer to this because we could show with our new study that it was a carbonaceous type asteroid. That's asteroids that formed further out in the solar system, initially beyond the orbit of Jupiter. And they contain like higher amounts of water, carbon and nitrogen compared to S-type asteroids, which are silicious type asteroids. They are composed out of silicate and metal, and they form more in the inner solar system. And new data show that the Chicxulub impactor was a carbonaceous type asteroid.
So the Chicxulub impactor that killed the dinos was basically like a flaming carbon-rich ball of rock, right?
Yeah, when it entered the Earth's atmosphere, of course, it was already starting to flame up. And when it smashed into the crustal rocks, then everything got vaporized at second. Yeah.
So is this composition pretty typical, or did this asteroid stand out?
Of course, the Chicxulub impact is, as you mentioned, is one of the most famous impacts. We wanted to compare this asteroid impact like to other impacts on Earth. And what our study also shows that within the last 500 million years, this Chicxulub impact is really a rare case of a C-type asteroid hitting the Earth, because all other impact structures that we investigated, they clearly match the compositions of S-type asteroids. So this is a really unique event so far.
Wow. So the dinosaurs got taken out by like a pretty rare kind of impact. That's unlucky for them, but maybe kind of lucky for us. Mario, I'm assuming we didn't actually have chunks of the dino-killing asteroid in question at hand to study. So how did you even figure this out?
Yes, when the asteroid impacted on Earth, we had a huge impact plume that developed, and the particles, dust particles, were dispersed into the atmosphere. And they could distribute all around the globe, basically. And then the particles were deposited into sedimentary layers that formed exactly 66 million years ago. And these sediment layers, they can be sampled. I was not the rock hunting guy in this study. That were, some of my colleagues did that. Actually, they did a great job. And they provided me with samples.
Very cool. So do we know where in the solar system this asteroid came from?
These C-type asteroids are interpreted to have formed beyond the orbit of Jupiter. And this is because they contain a lot of volatile elements. And these volatile elements could not condense closer to the sun because the temperatures in the inner solar system were too hot to allow for the condensation of, let's say, water or something like that. And that's why water and other volatile elements were incorporated only in asteroids that formed beyond what we call the snow line. And there, the volatile elements could be incorporated in this C-type asteroid material.
So I know that when we, you know, talk about space objects that are from this long ago, there's always the hope that they can tell us something about the early days of our solar system and even how it came to be. Can this asteroid teach us any of those lessons?
In principle, it could. However, we have asteroid samples, which in form of small fragments arrive on Earth as meteorites. And this material, of course, we can study in our laboratories. And from this material, we know that the C-type asteroid material is very volatile rich. especially it can contain up to 20% of water. And the basic idea is that the Earth primarily formed from silicious-type asteroid material, but in order to explain our water abundance on Earth, at some stage during the accretion of the Earth, we would have needed such C-type asteroid material incorporated to our planet in order to explain the water on Earth. By studying these asteroids, we can learn about the principal building blocks of our planets.
What other big questions do you have about asteroids and, you know, what research is next for you?
So during the last 500 million years in Earth's history, there were several major mass extinction events. And some of them are also thought to have been caused by an asteroid impact. And one of our future research tasks will be to eventually find traces of such impact events that could have also led to major mass extinction events in earlier days of the Earth. Another topic we will investigate at the University of Cologne is, for instance, we have a look at the moon. We see a heavily cratered surface, and the lunar surface is 4.4 billion years old. So it provides a collection of asteroid material that impacted onto the moon some billion years ago, and the same material would have also hit the Earth at that time. So we can also learn by studying these ancient lunar impact rocks, we can learn about what asteroid type was hitting the Earth in its very early days, and if this material could have delivered water to Earth.
Mario, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, many thanks for having me.
Dr. Mario Fischer-Gudde is a geochemist at the University of Cologne in Germany. The movie Slingshot, a sci-fi thriller about a years-long mission to Saturn's moon Titan, is out in theaters today. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, it follows the crew members as they start to unravel, highlighting how long, lonely missions can put astronauts' well-being in peril.
We have been in space for nearly 2 years.
You have two more hibernation cycles before the slingshot.
Houston, we have a situation.
The impact represents no real danger.
What if the whole system is compromised?
If we attempt a slingshot, we get blasted into deep space.
While the movie is definitely a work of science fiction, it does remind us that a lot can go wrong in space, both physically and mentally. So as humans get closer to embarking on long missions to places like Mars and beyond, how are real space agencies thinking about keeping them happy and safe? Science Friday's digital producer of Engagement, Emma Gomez, sat down with the film's director, along with a space psychologist, to answer those questions and more. Here's Emma.
Joining me to talk about the science of astronaut psychology that Slingshot puts on full display are Dr. Kelly Slack, an organizational psychologist who worked on space psychology for NASA, and Mikael Hofstrom, the film's director. And just a heads up to our audience, we'll discuss things that you might learn from the movie's trailer, but we won't spoil the film's many twists and turns. So welcome to both of you to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Mikael, what did you learn about this, like, long-term space travel concept while making the movie? Are you, like, a big sci-fi fan?
Well, yes, I like sci-fi, but I'm also interested in the human psyche. And I think space and spaceship is a great arena for stories about, you know, about loneliness and solitude and longing and self-reflection. In space, that's pushed to its limit. A few years ago, I made a film called 1408. It's a Stephen King adaptation with one character in a hotel room for most part of the film. They are relatives, that film 1408 and Slingshot, in a sense. We don't really know exactly what's going to happen with a human being so far away in space. So we have to guess and we have to talk to experts. And it's a work of fiction. And it's our take on what our characters go through during this special mission. And I hope the audience can feel with John, the main character in this film, and his struggles as human struggles, not only an astronaut's struggles.
Yeah, that's what interested me about it, too. And, I mean, Dr. Slack, as an expert in space psychology, what did you think of it before we get into the nitty-gritty of everything?
I thought the film was very interesting. I enjoyed watching it. And, of course, having the space background, having worked at NASA for a while, I came at it from a different perspective than I think the average audience member would.
Right. I mean, in the real world, how do space psychologists help keep astronauts mentally healthy in space on a long-term mission where you can't be in real-time communication with astronauts?
Space is an isolated, confined, extreme environment. It's not supposed to have humans in it. And humans are very social. And when you put that combination together, you get constrained humans who are in a limited social situation, and that creates a lot of stressors on them. So they are doing a lot of research on what kind of prevention should we have? What kind of countermeasures can we put in place? Meaning, what can we do to help them have the coping mechanisms and all the strategies that they need in order to have a successful mission? And then there's the third thing of, if something does occur, then what treatment options do we have?
And another thing I want to touch on was the group dynamic. How big a role would you say teamwork and that dynamic between the crew plays into astronaut well-being?
Extremely large. You have to have a team, and you have to have a team that works well together. And then you need a strong commander who will ensure that the team is staying as healthy as possible. There are a lot of different ways that NASA does this and other space agencies do this. One thing that's common for commanders is to have the entire crew spend at least one meal together a day so that they get that face-to-face time. On the space station, it's so large that you can go an entire day without running into other members of the crew. On a long-duration exploration mission, like is depicted in Slingshot, there would not be the luxury of that amount of space or capacity. The vehicle would not be that large, so you would be in closer proximity. So the work we've been doing shifts more towards what degree of privacy do the different people need versus how much togetherness do we have.
I mean, and you mentioned a strong commander. I feel like in this movie, there definitely is one, but it still contributes to the conflict. Without spoiling much, I would say that's true. So, Mikhail, like a NASA psychologist, I'm sure you thought a lot about group dynamics, too, and how that would impact the film. How did you think about the dynamics between the actors and how that would translate to the astronaut team in the movie?
I mean, it's interesting because it's a small environment, and the group dynamic is obviously key to make it all work in such a special situation, like being so far out in space. So we built this spaceship on a soundstage, and we didn't take out walls to shoot. We tried to keep it very sort of closed in, but that created a sense of claustrophobia, I think, that was really good for all of us that worked in the film. And we went in there in the morning, and we tried to avoid going out until we were finished shooting later in the day, just to help ourselves remind us where we were supposed to be on the ship. So, you know, the more we could push that sense of loneliness, the better for the actors to feel right in the situation.
So back to kind of the space psychology of it all. In the movie, the ship gets damaged and the crew just disagrees about what to do next. And it kind of reminded me of how the Boeing Starliner crew is sort of stuck on the space station right now. I mean, luckily they have guidance from Earth to decide their next move, but Dr. Slack, how are astronauts trained to manage disagreements about safety on a mission where real-time communication isn't possible or even when communication might be lost?
We have done a lot of prep work then if we don't have real-time communication. We put countermeasures on board to increase the likelihood that we can help them, even though it's not real-time. There would be kind of a dock in the box kind of thing, or AI-generated remote psychological help available for them. There was always a medical officer on board, whether they're a medical doctor or not, and they've been trained extensively in coping mechanisms and how to deal with stressors and how to be aware of that both in themselves and in others. We also would probably put something called proximity badges on them. The proximity badge is a way of us tracking to see if the patterns of interaction have changed over time. And if they do, then that gives us a heads up that there might be an issue later. And so then we can, even with a communication delay, start addressing the potential issue that might occur in the future. One other thing is putting control in the hands of the crew actually is pretty effective as far as giving them a dashboard where they can check their own vital signs, they can watch their own health status. And that puts a lot of control in their hands and gives them a lot of strength as well.
I wish that they had a space psychologist like you on the team at Slingshot. What's one of the most surprising things you've learned through your work as a space psychologist working with NASA?
I think for me is when we were looking at the space station as an analog to a long-duration exploration mission, one of the things I wanted to do, and I kind of flew this idea past a few people, but it never got more than 1 degree away from me. I wanted to cover all the windows on the station to see how the astronauts could cope without seeing Earth. One of the favorite things, actually the number one activity that astronauts enjoy doing when they're in space is taking photographs of the Earth or just sitting in the cupola, that mini windowed kind of bay window type thing that sticks out the side, and looking at the Earth. And when they go somewhere like Titan or Mars, they're not going to be able to see Earth. And you just really have to wonder what happens when we as humans who are so tied to our Earth, what happens when we are out there untethered, unable to see that which grounds us?
Right. I love that word, untethered. Okay. Well, thank you both for taking the time to talk about this.
Thank you so much. It's been very interesting. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Dr. Kelly Slack, organizational psychologist, and Mikael Hofstrom, director of the new movie Slingshot. It's out now.
Thanks for that, Emma. For more stories about science on the big screen, subscribe to Emma's newsletter, Science Goes to the Movies, at sciencefriday.com/movies. And that's all the time we have for this hour. Lots of folks helped make the show happen this week, including
Kathleen Davis,
Diana Plasker,
Beth Ramey,
Shoshana Buxbaum.
Thanks, everybody. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of this program, or if you've just got to hear it again, you can find it by subscribing to our podcasts. Or just ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. If you want to get in touch, email us at scifry@sciencefriday.com. I'm Rachel Feltman. Thanks for listening. This is Science Friday. I'm Rachel Feltman, sitting in for Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll take a look at how shifting seasons can change our behavior. Plus, with help from the James Webb Space Telescope, scientists may have identified 6 new rogue worlds. But first, spotted lanternflies are an invasive pest here in the U.S. The adults are about 1 inch long, they've got striking red and black markings, and, of course, spots. You've almost certainly seen them, or at least seen someone trying to stomp on one. Maybe you've even done some invasive pest control of your own. We've gotten the green light to attack these invasive insects because of their worrisome tendency to chow down on certain crops, particularly fruit trees. But even the most enthusiastic bug smasher is no match for this invasion, so scientists are trying out a new method for identifying and getting rid of these insects, training dogs to sniff them out. Joining me to talk about this strategy are my guests, Dr. Nathan Hall, director of the Canine Olfaction Research and Education Laboratory at Texas Tech, and Dr. Erica Feuerbacher, associate professor of applied animal welfare and behavior at Virginia Tech. Welcome, both of you, to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Nathan, I think most of us have seen drug-sniffing dogs in the airport. Is this project working with the same idea that you can train dogs to sniff out a particular object, in this case, a spotted lanternfly?
Yeah, so for a long time, we've known that dogs have this great sense of smell, and we've been using it mostly in terms of detection of explosives and narcotics. But recently, over the last like 15 to 20 years, that range has opened up a lot for a lot of conservation applications for trying to find species that are hard to detect or hard to find. USDA has been using them to find potential invasive things that might be coming in through airports. And now we're really looking at this from potential agricultural needs and agricultural services.
So what stage of insect development are the dogs trained to find? I can't help but picture them sort of leaping after the very spry adult bugs, which I assume is not what's happening.
Yeah, so right now we've been training the dogs to find these egg masses, which are these kind of brown, gloopy, I guess, egg masses that you could probably recognize on trees. But they also like to lay these on things like wood pallets or other things that you might pick up and transport to some location without even knowing that they're there. So instead of trying to find that like hoppy bug that you can easily see, we've been focused on those more hidden kind of egg masses that you wouldn't otherwise see, but might accidentally transport because you didn't know they were there.
And Erica, how do you actually go about training a dog to sniff out a lanternfly?
Yeah, so sniffing things is certainly a natural behavior for dogs. What we really have to train them to do is to communicate to us when they found their target odor. And we do that by teaching them that when they smell a certain odor, in this case, the egg masses of spotted lanternflies, that if they communicate to us, for example, sitting or staring or barking at us, that they'll get something that's highly valuable to them, either food or toys usually. So by making that odor valuable to them, they'll tell us where it is so they can get their preferred item.
And how many dogs have actually managed to develop a nose for lanternflies?
So we've had a really great recruitment effort. When we went into this grant, we proposed, kind of recruiting 120 teams or so. We had over 1,000 people register, wow, indicating their interest in our project. We unfortunately couldn't support that many teams. My graduate student, Sally Dickinson, does all the wrangling. So she has about 180 teams that she's recruited and is working with. But about 60 to 70% of the dogs that are participating and their handlers have passed our very specific tests that they have to do, which are quite challenging. And 60 to 70% of those dogs have been passing that, indicating that they can detect spotted lanternfly egg masses, both in a very controlled setting, but also out in really applied settings, out where it's busy and lots of other smells.
And what does that test actually look like?
So they have three levels of testing that they go through. The first one is called the odor recognition test. And if anybody does competitive scent work with their dogs, we've adapted those tests to our tests because those are a lot of the dogs that we have recruited. So that first test, they have a set of boxes out, many of which have distractor odors in them, like latex gloves or the mesh that we encapsulate the egg masses in. And only one or none of those boxes have spotted lanternfly egg masses. The dogs have 10 trials and they have to pass 80% of those. So they have to correctly identify where the odor is or that there is no odor on 8 out of 10 of those trials. If they succeed on that, then they can go to our field evaluation test, where they are given, it's outdoors, kind of in a lumber yard, like think of behind Lowe's. And we put out 3 to 5 odor spaces for them with lots of distractors because it's a natural environment. They have 5 minutes there and again have to correctly identify 80% on that test. If they succeed on that, then they can go to our deployment test. And that's really interesting. Dr. Hall mentioned that they're being trained on egg masses, and we are using killed egg masses because we, of course, don't want to contribute to any spread. The question is, can they transfer from the killed egg masses to live egg masses? And so in our deployment test, we're assessing that, and they absolutely can. The dogs are doing really phenomenally there and have even identified egg masses that we didn't know were there. They'll hit on something.
Oh, wow.
The humans have to dig around, and sure enough, there's an egg mass there.
Very cool. So once a dog sniffs out these live lanternfly eggs, what happens next? Is the idea that these egg masses get destroyed?
Exactly. So what we're hoping is that these dogs could be used to detect things that are being transported across the United States and prevent the increasing encroachment of these insects across the U.S. So the dogs could be deployed to go out and look at lumber yards or shipments. Mm.
And Nathan, another question for you. What makes dog noses particularly good for this job?
Well, dogs are quite interesting in that, one, they have great sort of noses in comparison to a lot of animals, but also they sort of have a similar sense of smell to other animals, but they're also just with us all the time. They make them super trainable. Mm. There have been studies that have been done with rats, or particularly large pouched rats, and they have phenomenal detection capabilities. but you're not going to be bringing those around to your lumber yard or to a variety of different checkpoints. So their sort of bond with us, their availability, and their unique capabilities in terms of how they sniff. There's a couple of things that they do that is quite unique in comparison to how we scent around the world. One is sniffing, right? When you think about, I'm going to take in a smell like McDonald's or a bakery, probably, whatever scent that you get, you take in this big inhale versus a dog is going to be sniffing at about 5 to 7 hertz. So that's breathing in and out 5 to 7 times within a second. And that causes unique airflow patterns that you don't get when you're just doing one continuous inhale. And then also just the way that the structure is of the dog's nose, they have a bigger sort of surface area of these olfactory receptors inside of their nose than we do.
Yeah, I'm picturing having drug-sniffing rats at the airport, and it's just a very different vibe. Though in New York, we already have so many rats. I don't know.
Well, maybe that might be a great community science project to leverage all of the rats.
Totally. Yeah, everybody wins. Well, and part of what makes spotted lanternflies such a big problem is that they spread so fast. You know, a decade ago, we didn't even have these insects in the U.S., and now we've got them in at least 16 states. So do you think this dog detection project can scale up enough to, you know, really slow the lanternflies down?
Well, I think, you know, there are two things. One is the spotted lanternfly, you can also think of like as a model for potential future situations where, you know, if we're developing this capacity and this capability, then we'll be so much more ready to deploy this in a future situation. But that's not to say that the spotted lanternfly story is a done deal, because where a lot of this spread is happening is going to be along human transport lines. But that means that there's a potential that if you had a detection technology to say, with relatively good accuracy in the lab, we were seeing 99% detection capabilities, 97% specificity. So if you had that, you know, capabilities, then you might at least be able to substantially reduce that spread that would then allow people, you know, because when you have things going so fast, it's hard to prepare, right? So if you can at least reduce that spread and put in place the things that might help prevent or at least tackle when they do come, you'd be in a much better prepared situation. Right now, the comparison is human eyes. So getting like a little mirror and sort of looking underneath the wood palette and seeing if there's something there. So that's where dogs are particularly excelling, is that potential capability to stop the spread or at least prevent some of that spread.
And Eric, I want to talk about the dogs in this study specifically. Are they like finished with their duties after a certain period of time? Do they get to retire off on a sunny beach afterwards?
So all of our dogs are owned dogs. And that's what's kind of unique about our project, is that we are not selecting dogs that were purpose bred or trained specifically for, you know, kind of a working career. These are dogs that people have as companions. We have a range of breeds from little tinies up to big ones, lots of mixed breeds. So it's really fun that anybody with a dog can participate. And some of Nathan's wonderful work has shown that, although I'm a German Shepherd fan myself, that pugs in his experiments outperform shepherds. So really, any dog can do this. But we see this project as a very cool way for their owners to partner with them. Their owners get to volunteer and contribute to their communities, and the dogs get a really fun enrichment activity. A lot of our participants want to keep doing more. And so that's one of our goals in the future, is how do we take these very motivated, very capable humans and dogs and make sure that they get to use their newly found expertise going forward.
Awesome. Nathan, your lab is also exploring using dogs to detect other invasive species. Which ones are you most excited about?
So we recently put out a paper on dog detection of zebra mussel veligers. They're these little larval stages of them that might come along in things like ballast water or other water samples that you wouldn't be able to see that they're in there. But turns out the dogs are actually able to detect them. But what makes them particularly powerful is that they're real time. They can give you an answer right now. It takes our dogs about 300 milliseconds to sniff something and tell us if something is present or not, whereas other technologies require you to then go filter that and give you a 48-hour, you know, downtime processing. Think of it like your rapid versus your long-time COVID tests or PCR COVID tests.
That's all the time we have for today, but I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Nathan Hall, director of the Canine Olfaction Research and Education Laboratory at Texas Tech, and Dr. Erica Feuerbacher, associate professor of applied animal welfare and behavior at Virginia Tech. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Listeners, if you want to read more about this project, you can head to our website, sciencefriday.com/sniff. That's sciencefriday.com/sniff. We have to take a break, and when we come back, how the changing timing of the seasons can impact our behavior. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Rachel Feltman. Maybe you've noticed lately that the seasons just don't quite behave like they used to. I'm an autumn girly myself. I love the crisp weather and the spooky vibes. And these days, fall just seems to happen in the blink of an eye, if it even happens at all. Spring flies by in a flash, too, while winter seems more erratic and intense, and summer goes on forever. This shift in the timing of the seasons is often called season creep. This phenomenon is mostly due to climate change creating temperature imbalances and encouraging wacky weather patterns year-round. And it can cause problems for plants and animals as their natural cycles fall out of sync. But what does it mean for human behavior? It's no surprise that the seasons can affect our mood. You've probably heard of seasonal affective disorder, often called seasonal depression, which tends to hit during the cold, dark winter months. But as the seasons start changing more quickly and unpredictably, the shift could have a wide range of effects on us that we're only just beginning to understand. Joining me today to try to answer some of these questions is Dr. Michael Varnum, social psychology area head and associate professor at Arizona State University. Welcome to Science Friday. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, Rachel.
So you and your colleagues recently wrote a paper on the topic of human seasonality. Could you explain what that means and why it's an important topic to unpack?
Sure thing. So we got interested in this question of, you know, when we look at many other non-human animals, if we think about, you know, brown bears and squirrels that hibernate in the winter, or Canada geese, which fly south in the fall in search of warmer weather, we look across the animal kingdom and we look at plants as well. And we see a wide range of seasonal effects on their physiology and behavior. And when we think about ourselves, most of us are aware of some of these seasonal shifts in mood, but in fact, it turns out that we're fairly seasonal creatures as well.
Yeah. So what are some of the ways that seasons can influence human behavior?
A lot of things seem to follow seasonal patterns in our species. So it's not just this sort of tendency to increase feelings of depression in wintertime. Recent work by some of my collaborators actually suggests that anxiety seems to peak in spring and fall. And we also see changes in things like aggressive behavior. So we've known for some years, looking at crime statistics and other sources of data, that people get a little more violent and aggressive in the summertime. But it also turns out, if we look at generosity, that tends to peak in the wintertime. There's a bump in charitable giving and even how much people leave as tips at restaurants around the Christmas holidays. And beyond that, we see changes in everything from the kinds of foods we eat and levels of exercise to our preferences for different kinds of colors and even our sexual behavior. So it turns out in the summertime and also again around the holidays, a variety of sources of data looking at sort of large surveys of people's frequency of sex, as well as internet searches for things like pornography and condom sales. These seem to show biannual peaks as well.
Wow, that's so interesting. Do we have any idea why seasons can affect us in these ways?
Yeah, so some of these changes probably have to do with the way amounts of sunlight and heat affect our neurotransmitters and our hormones. There's emerging evidence suggesting that, you know, serotonin tends to start to bottom out in the wintertime, and sex hormones like estrogen and testosterone, according to large analyses of medical records, seem to have biannual peaks in the winter and summer as well. But more broadly, we also see, you know, when we think about seasonal changes, it's not just the temperature or whether we're getting snow or how much light we're getting that changes. Other aspects of our environment that have been shown to affect our behavior also shift. So if we think about the wintertime, right, this is cold and flu and now COVID season, So the threat of infectious disease tends to follow cyclical patterns. And that's been linked from everything to our tendency to conform, to how willing we are to try new things, to whether folks are suspicious of people who are unfamiliar or don't look like them. We also see shifts, for example, in places like Arizona, where I live. We get influxes of guests and tourists in our winter months because it's a lot nicer here than, say, up in Canada or the Midwest. And so the density of population can shift seasonally, and that can affect the extent to which we engage in long-term planning. And in addition to this, seasons also have kind of cultural associations, right? Christmas, Hanukkah, a lot of other holidays fall in those December months. But we also see, right, we can think about the cycles of the school year and other ways in which our lives are sort of structured in these seasonal patterns. And likely some of these effects that have been observed are due to kind of a complex interplay of these factors.
Hmm. And it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, sort of respiratory disease spikes. I know there's been a lot of talk this summer in particular about COVID spikes in the summer. And I've seen some public health experts speculate that maybe as summers are getting more oppressively hot and people are spending more time indoors in the AC, you know, the sort of traditional wisdom about viral transmission being lower in the summer because everyone's enjoying time outside might be, you know, less of a truth these days. Do you have any thoughts on other ways that climate change and season creep could be impacting those effects on our behavior? And is anyone researching that specific question?
Yeah, those are great questions. So, you know, one of the big effects of climate change, aside from season creep, is that our summers are not only getting longer, but they're getting hotter. And there's emerging research on sort of what do extreme high temperatures and exposure to them do to our health and our psychology. In a recent review, this was by Roney and Alamagir, found that we get more irritable when we're exposed to these really hot temperatures. Which kind of makes sense, right? But also that our sleep tends to be disrupted. We tend to experience decreased motivation and increased feelings of helplessness, which, you know, living in the Phoenix Valley when it's been above 110 for, oh, a month and a half straight sometimes, yeah, we do feel pretty gloomy about life in general and like we're doomed. So a lot of things might be responding to this increase in extreme heat.
Yeah, absolutely. I know in the New York City area, we had a brief sort of false fall and then sort of normal August weather. And now we've crept back up into heat wave territory. And I am definitely feeling less hopeful. But I hope that autumn is still in sight. So how can seasons happening earlier or later disrupt our behavior patterns?
So there's some research emerging for other species, right? If we look at migratory birds, over the past few decades, they're actually starting to shift those migration patterns by about 5 to 10 days over the past few decades. Animals that hibernate are sort of arising from their stupor about 2 weeks earlier than they were earlier in this, about half a century ago or so. Insect populations are sort of emerging and hitting their peaks later. And so, you know, again, it's not just these other animals that are likely to be affected by these shifts in seasons and their timing, but a lot of the effects we talked about just a few moments ago in humans, we might expect the timing of those to begin to change as well.
Yeah. And what about sort of the actual shift from season to season itself? You know, I know a lot of folks in my area feel like we go right from summer heat waves that last way longer than they used to. And then suddenly it's dark and it's cold and we haven't had that, you know, autumn time to recover. How might that impact our behavior based on what we know about human seasonality?
I think that's a fascinating question. So, you know, we might expect that some of these effects that we see in terms of psychological or behavioral changes that seem to be strongest in spring and fall, I guess they might become muted. So for example, you know, it turns out studies of college students suggest that working memory is best in the fall and worst in the spring. But maybe you're going to see more sort of year-round stability in some of these cognitive effects. I'm not entirely certain, but I think these are fascinating questions for us to begin to look into and track. And maybe things that, you know, with enough archival data, right? Climate change isn't exactly new. We may be able to look back and see evidence, right, of shifts in sort of the strength or timing of these peaks in things like aggressive behavior or changes in mood or, you know, changes in our memory and cognition.
And as we touched on earlier, you know, one commonly known psychological effect of season shifting is seasonal affective disorder. So could you talk a little bit about what that is and why it happens?
It seems like as best we can understand it, our bodies seem to respond to the amount of sunlight we're exposed to. And as the days shorten, we're exposed to less of it, and we seem to make less serotonin, which appears to have effects on our mood. For some people, that leads to clinical levels of depression. But large-scale surveys and also analysis of data from, you know, what people are posting on social media and what they're searching for suggests that actually for a lot of people, we see these decreases in mood in the wintertime. You know, scientists have speculated a bit about, you know, why might this be? Is there perhaps some adaptive property of why we get a little sad in the wintertime? And it actually, if we step back from it, there's a lot of parallels to what happens in hibernating animals. And so for most of our history, we didn't have very good climate control, right? We didn't have electric heat or air conditioning. We didn't have grocery stores. So food might have become scarce in the winter. So it would have been adaptive, at least in latitudes where you really had these very cold months where not a lot of stuff would grow, for us to kind of conserve energy. And this might explain the sort of decrease in motivation. It might explain why we're sort of moving and exercising less, why we're eating more and packing on the pounds. When we're feeling happier, we tend to be more energetic. We burn more calories. And so this might in some ways be a holdover from sort of most of our evolutionary history.
Yeah, that's super interesting. On my podcast, The Weirdest Thing I Learned This Week, we've talked a few times about the idea of second sleep, you know, before electric light. A lot of cultures had these, you know, two phases of sleep, and it was like the sun's going down, so why would you stay up? But you're getting more sleep than you need, so you wake up in the middle of the night, you do a couple of things with your one candle and then go back to bed. And I remember reading some scholars from the time actually said that, you know, the best time to try to conceive a child was between your two sleeps because your energy would be at its highest level. So, yeah, I love thinking about just the ways that our routines have changed so much now that, you know, we can control when we have light and how warm our house is. And yeah, I think it's important to remember that, you know, maybe our bodies are really trying to help us out by getting us to slow down in the winter. But what about the other side of the coin? You know, what are some positive impacts or benefits that seasons changing can bring us?
Well, if we look at the data that Ian Holm and Mark Schaller analyzed on anxiety, I mean, I was kind of surprised to read these results, but that, you know, anxiety seems to be peaking in fall and spring when they look at the sort of annual cycles of it. And so maybe we'll get less anxious if we have less fall and spring. I don't know.
Interesting. And how would you suggest that people prepare for seasonal mood changes?
So I think it may be helpful for a lot of people to realize that these are kind of natural cycles we go through in mood. You know, I imagine in the therapeutic context, knowing that, you know, maybe what's going on in terms of your feelings isn't entirely due to, you know, something idiosyncratic in your life that's awful or oppressing or depressing, but that this is part of, you know, sort of a wave that goes up and down and in a regular fashion. And that, you know, it's likely to pass as the sun comes creeping back out again. I'm not a clinician, but I imagine knowing that would probably be somewhat helpful. We also know, right, because in this modern world where we have all these conveniences, we can purposefully engage in more exercise, which is one thing that's been shown to be really, really effective at improving our mood, reducing feelings of depression and anxiety. So maybe, you know, knowing that this is coming, that it's natural, but also proactively taking some steps to do things that we know will improve mood, seem like they might be good strategies to deal with these seasonal fluctuations and how we're feeling.
Absolutely. And how can we prepare for seasons getting less predictable in the future with climate change?
I mean, that's a tough one. You know, in one line of work, I'm interested in looking at sort of long patterns of societal and psychological change and thinking about how we can maybe forecast the future of these. So we do have good meteorological and climate data. We have decent archival data going back at least long enough to detect some of these seasonal effects. So I imagine if we can model what these seasonal, how the seasons will change going forward, we might also be able to make some useful forecasts for things like, you know, birth rates and reproductive behavior, rates of crime, changes in sort of mental illness symptomology that, you know, should be helpful for policymakers, those in the healthcare industry, folks, you know, trying to decide how to allocate resources to deal with these issues.
Yeah, well, and I suppose there are parts of the world that already have a lot less seasonal change than I'm used to, having grown up on you know, in the Northeast. So maybe I can pick up some tips from folks in Arizona and California. What would you like to see researched or studied about this in the future?
Well, you know, I think seasons are an interesting question in the behavioral sciences. It's one of those where it's such a ubiquitous part of life that we've taken them for granted and not really thought in too concentrated a way about what kinds of effects they may have. And so it's pretty common for psychologists now to report, you know, where that in the world they gather their data and how old their participants were and what their, you know, demographic backgrounds are, because we know this stuff matters. But we don't really pay attention to when we conduct our research. And if seasons affect this wide range of behaviors and mental states, you know, everything from mood to sexuality to aggression, then it might be important to start paying a little more attention to that. And also to be thinking about, you know, can we make some predictions for how things that might be a little less obvious might change over the course of the year? My colleagues and I, Mark Schaller and Ian Holm at UBC, we're actually running some big longitudinal studies right now, looking at, you know, whether there might be seasonal shifts in things like xenophobia or seasonal changes in our orientation to individualism or collectivism, or how motivated we are to find new romantic partners versus take care of family. And hopefully, you know, in another couple seasons, we'll have some answers for you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I can't wait to read the actual scientific research on cuffing season, as TikTok calls it. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been super interesting.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me on today.
That was Dr. Michael Varnum, social psychology area head and associate professor at Arizona State University, Tempe, Arizona. After the break, we'll go on a hunt for rogue worlds. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Rachel Feltman. Did you know that when you look up at the stars, almost every single one has at least one planet orbiting around it? That's wild, right? But here's something even wilder. There are some celestial bodies that look a lot like planets, but just float around freely in the cosmos, unattached to any particular star. They're called rogue worlds, and with data from the James Webb Space Telescope, astrophysicists just identified six right here in our own Milky Way galaxy. So what can we learn from these rogue worlds? Can they teach us anything about how stars and planets are formed? Joining me to tell us more are two of the study's authors, astrophysicist Dr. Adam Langeveldt, as well as Dr. Ray Jayawardena, a professor of physics and astronomy. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good to be here, Rachel.
Yeah, thank you for having us today.
Thanks so much for being here. So, Adam, what exactly is a rogue world?
So, a rogue world is kind of an object, a planetary mass object that kind of free floats in space, untethered to any star. There are kind of two ways that this can come about. The first is that these rogue objects can be formed similarly to stars, where there's a kind of cloud of gas and dust that gravitationally contracts and kind of forms this orb, this planet-star-like object. But it doesn't reach the required mass to ignite fusion in its core to begin its life as a star. And then it can just, if it doesn't have enough mass, just drift in space alone, behaving as a kind of a rogue floating object. The other way is that it could be formed around another star, as planets do, like our solar system. And so a planet like Jupiter, for example, could form in the disk around a star that's just formed as well. And then if it is in a kind of dense cluster, for example, a dense cluster of stars that are also forming, it could interact with the gravity of another star and get ejected out of its system and just end up just floating endlessly in space. So these rogue worlds are very interesting kind of single objects that we can now start to see.
So path one is that a cloud of dust and gas collapses, and path two is that a planet forms around a star but gets chucked out of its orbit. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So, Ray, tell me about the six rogue worlds that you found. Where are they?
So these happen to be in a nearby star cluster that itself is rather young, just a couple of million years old, and it's about 1,000 light years from our solar system, which means it's still very much in our neighborhood. And thanks to the incredible sensitivity of the Webb telescope, particularly at infrared wavelengths, we're able to probe deeper into this star cluster and identify objects fainter than ever before possible.
Do we have any idea how many rogue worlds, or in science speak, free-floating planetary mass objects there are in the Milky Way in total?
The census of objects for this particular star cluster, NGC 1333, gives us the sense that maybe 10% of the members of the cluster have planetary masses. Our best estimate is that there are a couple of hundred billion stars in the galaxy. So if something like 10% of objects in the galaxy are planetary mass, that would get us into the billions.
Wow, very cool. So, Adam, with so many potential rogue worlds, what makes these six exciting?
So these six objects that we found in this recent study are particularly interesting, since they're some of the lightest objects that we've found of this type, and that is these free-floating objects in space. Now that is thanks to the real improvement in sensitivity provided by James Webb compared to any of the other telescopes that we've been able to look at these regions before. So what we find is six objects that are between 5 to 15 Jupiter masses. They're kind of large gaseous objects. And what we don't find is that there is no object below this mass, even though our experiment and our observations were designed to detect objects down to one Jupiter mass. And so we really think that we have found, at least in the region we are looking at, some of the lowest mass objects that exist in this region. And that gives us a lot of important context for star and planet formation.
To build on what Adam said, in some sense, what's more striking is what we didn't find. We're excited to have discovered a handful of new planetary mass objects that are free-floating, not circling stars, down to about 5 times the mass of Jupiter in this star-forming region. But we did not find an abundance of even lighter objects, despite the Webb telescope having sufficient sensitivity to do so. That suggests that if even lighter objects exist, they must be relatively rare in this young star cluster. In other words, it's intriguing to wonder if we are reaching the lowest mass objects that might form the way that stars do, through the contraction of a cloud of gas and dust. So we're getting at a very basic fundamental question: how low in mass and can an object form the way that stars do? And the idea, you know, the star formation process is quite astounding to think about. The most massive stars could be 100 times the mass of the sun. And the lowest mass object we found here in this cluster is about 5 times the mass of Jupiter. The fact that nature can produce objects ranging in mass by a factor of 20,000 through a set of physical processes is rather mind-boggling to consider.
Yeah. And do you think that, you know, because these objects are so low mass that you might be witnessing them at the beginning of their formation?
Well, given the very youth of the cluster, we are indeed looking at these objects relatively early in their lives, the same way that stars in the cluster show evidence of youth. In fact, the lightest object we found, the 5 Jupiter mass object among the handful, is surrounded by a disk of dust and gas itself.
Tell me more about that dusty disk that you discovered on one of the rogue worlds. How does it compare to rings we might be more familiar with, like the ones on Saturn?
We would think of it as a scaled-down version of what our own sun started with, a protoplanetary disk out of which our solar system coalesced. What we see in the case of Saturn is not a primordial disk or primordial ring that we're witnessing today. The rings of Saturn probably formed through collisions of larger bodies generating new particles. So here we are thinking about a planetary mass object that was born with a disk of gas and dust surrounding it, the way we assume our own sun was born, and the way we do actually observe other young stars to be surrounded by circumstellar disks.
So I guess that's another indication that we're seeing something at a really early stage of its life. And just to make sure I have this right, you're saying that because it has this disk, it probably formed like a star. I guess if it had been an ejected planet, any disk it might have had would have fallen apart when it got chucked out into space. Is that right?
That seems likely. The kind of gravitational kick that would eject such an object would also likely disrupt a surrounding disk, or at least a sizable disk, from being carried away with it as it got ejected. So the evidence points to that 5 Jupiter mass object with a disk is more likely to have formed the way that stars do.
And given that the mass is so low, or it's the lowest mass object that we found with a disk, again, it just points to the fact that this could be the potential limit or near the limit of how light of an object can form like a star, which is the big overarching question that we were trying to investigate with this work.
So rogue worlds don't fit neatly into the box of either planets or stars. And I'm curious, as scientists, do you find that frustrating or exciting?
For me, it's a great curiosity and an exciting curiosity, because every day we find things that don't fit into those boxes. We find wonders that make us go, wow, there must be some different types of things out there that we've never even imagined. It's interesting itself because, as we kind of overviewed earlier, there is this overlap between those objects like this that form like planets and the objects that form like stars in terms of their masses, that the masses at which these objects can be overlaps. And so trying to narrow that down and trying to narrow down their specific kind of type is very interesting for me.
The blurring of boundaries is interesting, fascinating in itself, but it also means that the study of free-floating planetary mass objects like these can shed light on both the star formation process, but also the process of planet formation. That overlap is perhaps a little confusing at first blush, but it certainly scientifically is deeply interesting and potentially tells us about two separate processes in nature.
Yeah, very cool. Well, and I want to ask about the image from James Webb that accompanied your study. It's so stunning. You know, it's the sea of orange and blue and purple with stars glittering everywhere. Adam, how did you react when you first saw that?
I thought it was very, very beautiful. It was a step-by-step process. So we got the initial images that need to be then kind of filtered and colored and kind of put together, because they're taken in seven parts. But once those images came together, it really was a magnificent sight, and something that definitely made us motivated to continue to investigate and look deeper into what we see in the data, in the spectra that we get as well alongside it.
Yeah. And could you explain a little bit more about how these images get put together? I'm always fascinated by the creation of like these breathtaking images that are maybe not what I'd see if I just took a rocket ship there, and definitely not what each individual instrument sees. But yeah, how does that all come together?
Yeah. So firstly, the image that has been kind of released on the in the news articles is a mosaic of several kind of squares that we take in this region. So firstly, those have to be kind of merged together. Secondly, is that we take this same image in multiple filters. That is to take the image looking at two different wavelengths such that objects appear brighter in different wavelengths. And by doing this, we can get the kind of color gradient. We can apply a color to the lower wavelength and a different color, for example, red to the higher wavelength. And by then combining those two together, we get this nice gradient in color that shows so vividly and so nicely in the final image that we see.
And remember, these images are taken at infrared wavelengths, not in the visible part of the spectrum. And the Webb telescope is particularly capable of giving us a good infrared view of the universe. The beauty of the NIRIS instrument on Webb that we used for this project is that not only are we able to obtain these stunning images of a star-forming region, but we also get a spectrum of every object in our field of view. That means in one fell swoop, we can identify out of hundreds of point sources in the field which are the most interesting, which handful of faint objects are most relevant when we are exploring the lowest mass free-floating objects in this new cluster.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of the James Webb Space Telescope, Ray, I know that you worked on the James Webb. So how does it feel to work with data from the system you helped build?
It's thrilling. I've been involved with a team that developed the NIRIS instrument for Webb for 2 decades now. And this particular project of targeting a young star cluster to probe the planetary mass regime in it has been in the works for 10 years. And I remember watching with some mix of excitement and trepidation the launch of Webb on Christmas Day of 2021 with my 2 kids, with so much writing on it, the work of thousands of engineers, scientists, and others over decades, and also so much potential for scientific discovery. And it's truly gratifying and thrilling to see the Webb telescope performing so spectacularly. And we're able to do science that simply was not within the reach of humanity until now.
Wow, yeah. So my last question for both of you is, now that you've found these rogue worlds, what's next? What else are you hoping to find out?
So we're in particular trying to learn more about these free-floating planetary mass objects. We are targeting a handful of similar objects with evidence of dusty disks around them, so we can learn about those disks, determine if they're sizable, which might provide a clue as to whether such objects formed in situ the way stars do, or whether they were in some cases, they've formed as planets and were later ejected. In fact, we have an observing program with Webb that's underway now. The very first data for that follow-up project were taken just a week ago.
One thing that I would like to add to that, and something that I'm very curious and interested in myself, is that the nature of these objects that we do see in this region, and I would like to try to characterize their composition. For example, with the NIRIS data that we got, the instrument on JWST, we only obtained the spectrum over a very narrow wavelength range, which gives us a nice information, but relatively limited information about their composition. And so it would be great to really observe these in more detail over a much wider wavelength range with other instruments on the JWST, to see if we can really narrow down their composition. For example, we might expect them to have molecules such as water, carbon monoxide, maybe methane, which would really also give us a nice insight into their formation conditions as well, and their comparison to both exoplanets and stars and the lowest mass stars. So that for me is also very interesting.
Well, I think that's all the time we have. Adam and Ray, thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you for having us. Yeah, it was very, very nice to chat.
It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Adam Langeveld is an astrophysicist at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Ray Jayawardena is a professor of physics and astronomy, also at Hopkins. That wraps up this week's show. If you missed any part of this program or you'd just like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts. You can also join us throughout the week on social media or with our newsletters. You can find those at sciencefriday.com/newsletters. Have a great weekend. I'm Rachel Feltman.